we had learned that VHAP is related to two things, and metabolism inside the cytosol. VHAP is related to this aldehyde and phosphate in a way that I've tried to indicate with the blue writing. And I guess we discovered that first because we discovered that as a step-in glycolysis. What's in blue here is a step-in glycolysis. A reversible step is going in the glycolysis direction. GHAP becomes glycerolamide. And at that time, it was useful to realize these classifications that I've written in blue. GHAP is a ketose. A ketone sugar. A ketose. And it might also help when we come to looking at the enzyme change for this reaction to point out that DHAP is a triose phosphate. It's a triose because it's a three carbon sugar and it's a triose phosphate because it's a phosphate. And then glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, it's an aldose. recognizes this reaction here, the second and last reaction of the shuttle is ideal. Because at this point, I'd say the electrons have reached the electron transport chain. I'll take you back to a picture we looked at when we looked at the electron transport chain earlier and apply this to remind you of us finding it. So where it says here, the conclusion of this diagram, that the electrons now are in the electron transport chain, or can at least be given to the electron transport chain, depending on your perspective of where that chain starts here. I think you realize where the electrons go next, because I just reminded you that previous picture, chapter 21, where the electrons go next after they leave mitochondrial glycerol free phosphate dehydrogenase, or after they leave these FAD2Hs, you might say, where do they go next? Who gets them next? You've got to make sure you're making this connection to the next coenzyme Q. Just like the figure 1.5 should be. Did these electrons ever go through complex 1?
become very convenient to think of them as so related that they're almost two forms of the same thing, one's the ketone form and the other one's the alcohol. And to realize then that it's the alcohol form or the malate that is the more reduced form, the relatively electron rich form. And so in this diagram, well, they can be easier to blue coloring. It's the malate that has the electrons at this point. And there are protein doorways in the inner mitochondrial membrane that allow malate to now enter the mitochondria. It's the malates that have the electrons. different are these two different forms of malate dehydrogenase and cytosolic version and mitochondrial version? The answer would be that they are coded for by different genes, and that the mitochondrial version has a part of its structure that sort of addresses it or targets it to the mitochondria so that it ends up in that location. It's got a part of its structure that makes sure it ends up in the mitochondria. And the cytosolic version doesn't have it because it's certain to everything in the cytosol. There is more to this diagram down here that I'm saying, but I'm going to look at it. It just gets back to where you started. It shows how this oxaloacetate can become oxaloacetate where we started. And that's the part that involves aspartate, or aspartate, I don't care how you pronounce it, I say aspartate. That's an amino acid. And now oxaloacetate turns into an amino acid called aspartate. It's something that a diversion right now from our main point. But it becomes necessary pretty quickly when we get to the next set of learning objectives for me to talk about such things as how an alpha ketone acid can become an acid. So that is coming up. It won't be missing any of the data. Now, objective number 13. I'm going to put forth a challenge to you. I like to call this the 30 to 32 challenge. You see, you've heard, now that we've talked about these cells, you've heard everything you need to know at one point or another in what's been addressed in this class. Why people would say that if you start doing a tally for how many ATPs a cell could make maximum using one glucose molecule as fuel, why they would say 30 to 32 ATPs. Let me give you some hints that would make it more doable, and then let you try it on your own, or come see me in a tutorial my representation. As you're trying to explain how a cell might possibly get that many ATPs, 30 to 32, using just one glucose molecule as fuel, make sure you use glycolysis. It starts with glycolysis. And then continue in an aerobic way, involving the reaction catalyzed by pyruvate dehydrogenase. And use shuttles to send the electrons from glycolysis to the electron transport chain. And use the PCA cycle. And use oxidative phosphorylation. You've got to use all that aerobic business. You're never going to explain cell making methods of aging plants from single glucose. And when you encounter the production of GTP, this would be one step of the PCA cycle. You might say per glucose, the PCA cycle happens twice. So when you get a couple of GTPs in this calculation, count them as ATPs. The people that say there's 30 to 32 ATPs possible, they're counting GTPs as ATPs. So allow yourself to count those as ATPs. Now I'll put this challenge to you. Explain how you come up 30 to 32, as step by step as you can explain. And I'm going to go on to objective 14, where it's time to return to the point that glycolysis is not just for energy. It's a pathway with a dual function. It produces not only energy, it also produces dopamine. So let's talk about because this diagram shows the synthesis of fat, I think a good scenario, a good set for this diagram would be liver cells in the fed state after a high carbohydrate. An ideal setting for this picture would be liver cells in the fed state after a high carbohydrate. Have to be a place where I would expect and a setting in which I would expect glucose to be turned into fat. And let's maybe make that be the most important building project in this picture, because it's a building project that you can turn into over and over and over and over and over. So you understand step by step and get a form of how that happens. Pretty good diagram for beginning those efforts. I'll fix it in a place where I think I can make it even better. There's a couple of places I can make it really good. But let's notice that right here, serine and alanine, those are amino acids. Those are amino acids being made from some of the intermediates of glycolysis, so pyruvate is the end product of glycolysis. Pyruvate can be turned into alanine, and 3-phosphoglycerine can be turned into serine. So this is illustrating how you can make not only those two amino acids, but actually a significant number of amino acids using carbons from glucose. And glycolysis is important to that building process. Building that, building amino acids from glucose. Building amino acids like serine or alanine. If you're going to make amino acids from glucose, you need glycolysis. You need at least some of the steps of glycolysis. And how about this arrow here that says, well, you need at least the first step of glycolysis. If you want to make some 5-carbon sugars from glucose, you need this first step of glycolysis where glucose becomes glucose 6-phosphate. And then the glucose 6-phosphate enters a pathway that I tried to name for you rather recently, so I'm going to write it down. Name that pathway and return the glucose 6-phosphate to 5-carbon sugars, most importantly, ribose 5-phosphate. Pentose phosphate pathway. Yeah, trying to work that pathway's name into our vocabulary so we can reveal a little bit more about that pathway as we go on. I ask you to know glucose 6-phosphate can go into that pathway, and that pathway can then produce ribose 5-phosphate, which would be needed for making nucleotides. And nucleotides are the building blocks for nucleic acids, like your DNA, your RNA. And we can already realize that nucleotides are incredibly important. ATP, by God, what is a nucleotide? ATP is a nucleotide. And so when your body has to make nucleotides, where does it get the ribose 5-phosphate from? Now let's go back to what I said is maybe the most important for this quarter, the most important part of this diagram, and that would be the building project that is needs fat. Now to make fat, you need glycerol backbones and you need fatty acids. Here it says glycerol phosphate. I wish they had put the 3 in there to make it say glycerol 3-phosphate. Somebody that we've talked about quite a bit now. You remember glycerol 3-phosphate, don't you? You remember where it comes from? One place it can come from. I guess I haven't told you all the places it can come from, but one place it can come from that you were told about today is it can come from the reduction of PHAD. That was included in our discussion of one of the shows. because what they're talking about is drawing 5-3 through glycolysis. Running with the glucose at the very top of the picture, drawing 5-3 through glycolysis. As far as DHAPs are made, we've looked at that already, how DHAPs are made in glycolysis, and how one use of DHAPs, rather than having them simply continue through glycolysis, which some of them might do, but another use of DHAPs is to turn them into glycerol backbones looking back. A reduction where now I think you can name the enzyme that catalyzes this. This arrow right here that goes from DHAP to glycerol triphosphate.
Hydrogenase.
Good. I heard what you would say or mumble. Glycerol triphosphate to dehydrogenase. That is the cytosol. Your question was, is glycerol phosphate the same thing as glycerol 3 phosphate? Yes. Yes, it is. Well, yet, you've seen twice today, one right after the other, two different reasons for changing DHAP to glycerol 3 phosphate. The first time was to send some electrons to the electron transport chain, where the glycerol 3 phosphate shuttle starts off this way, and then the glycerol 3 phosphate serves as an electron carrier and goes right back to being DHAP by giving the electrons next to some FADs of mitochondria. That's how that changed. This time, we're talking about making glycerol 3 phosphate from DHAP not to be an electron carrier, but to be glycerol backbone for fat molecules using the glycerol 3 phosphate. Still, the enzyme to change DHAP into glycerol 3 phosphate is glycerol 3 phosphate dehydrogenase. If you're going to build fat from glucose, you need to not only make the glycerol backbones from glucose, but you also need to make the fatty acids from glucose. All of that is possible. Maybe I should say that you can. Not only the glycerol backbones, but also the fatty acids from glucose. In a way that's fairly nicely illustrated here, but I want to make one slight improvement to it. I know it will help you connect this to the simulation part of the study. To use carbons from glucose to yield these fatty acids, you would want those carbons to go all the way through glycolysis, becoming carbons of pyruvates. And you'd want the pyruvates then to go into the mitochondrial matrix where the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction occurs. I should have asked you guys to name this enzyme. Pyruvate dehydrogenase, and we see perhaps this is the abbreviation that we're using. Have the pyruvate from the glucose go into mitochondrial matrices, into the mitochondrial matrix to form acetyl-CoA. Reaction catalyzed by pyruvate dehydrogenase. And then this shows, here's where I might want to change the diagram a little bit. This shows the acetyl-CoAs donating their acetyl groups to build fatty acids. But to better connect this to some things that you've already seen, things that you already know, we should be rehearsing at this point. Let me add a little bit more detail. What really happens, rather than these acetyl groups of acetyl-CoAs going directly out from the mitochondrial matrix into the cytosol, where fatty acid synthesis occurs. Instead of that, what happens is the acetyl groups go into the TCA cycle one step how we saw it when we looked at Jesus 2017. That was that when we were looking at the cycle, we looked at the 2017, and we found citrate leaving the GCA cycle, leaving the mitochondrial matrix going out into the cytosol. So I showed acetyl-CoA going into the GCA cycle. I showed the word citrate right here when I wrote that into my book. I wrote citrate right here and changed the dotted line slightly to show the citrate would be the mitochondrial matrix. Those are the cytosol and that acids. I really want you to be working on the details and eventually have all the details down for this building project that would occur. Well, I said liver cells in the fed state after a high carbohydrate meal, but also in other things. It would be a different state. In the same setting, fed state after a high carbohydrate meal. Those are the two places that I mentioned earlier in the book, talking about the fed state issue, where I would expect a lot of fat synthesis after a high carbohydrate meal. Liver cells and using glucose. Let's take our 10 minutes break. For all the reversal mistakes, got your pencil or whatever. Well, they already did a good job of showing this step as reversal. They should have shown this step as reversible as well. They should make that arrow go both directions. And all three of these arrows should go both directions. Those are reversible steps. They go one direction for glycolysis, but they go the other direction using the exact same enzymes for gluconeogenesis. The first reversible step, well, they did a good job of showing that happened. But then this is reversible. They did a good job of showing that one as reversible. But they should have shown these as reversible. And then one more. The lactate dehydrogenase reaction right here. That's reversible. That's going beyond the steps of glycolysis, however. We've now made it more clear, I think, with those additions. Which steps are the irreversible steps? And it's really standing out as this one and this one. And this one are the irreversible steps of glycolysis. And we're going to with the learning objectives talking about controllers or those controls. So objective 15 starts off with this step right here, where the enzyme could be exokinase, like this diagram shows. Also know that you would associate this with liver cells, then another possibility is glucokinase as the enzyme in that first step of glycolysis. And this diagram is trying to indicate to you right here that glucose 6-phosphate can inhibit exokinase. That's kind of a logical example of feedback inhibition. That would slow down the production of glucose 6-phosphate if it starts to accumulate. Feedback inhibition. It's an allosteric mechanism, however, I feel I need to tell you that the enzyme exokinase has an allosteric site distinct from the catalytic reactive site. An allosteric site that glucose 6-phosphate will bind to. And that makes it so that when glucose 6-phosphate begins to accumulate, the concentration of it starts to rise, the enzyme exokinase will spend more. cells, the enzyme for this first step is not hexokinase, but glucokinase. And it is an inducible enzyme. Glucokinase in liver cells is an inducible enzyme. And when I describe an enzyme as inducible, the picture I hope I've painted in your minds is the synthesis of it can be sped up by something binding to DNA. This would be a transcription factor, some protein that I might call a transcription factor binding to DNA and causing an increased expression of the gene that codes for the enzyme. That's the picture I hope comes to mind when I say an enzyme is inducible. And maybe question you would ask would be, under what conditions would that happen that liver cells start to make more glucokinase? And it would be when liver cells should be glucose users. That could be in the fed state after a high carbohydrate meal that you would want liver cells to be glucose users. You'd want liver cells to be especially good at trapping glucose and using it for building projects in the fed state after a high carbohydrate meal. That's when liver cells should have more than sex on glucokinase. So what hormone do you think stimulates liver cells to produce more glucokinase? Yes. So this information might be spoken of this way. Glucokinase is inducible by enzymes. Inducible by enzymes. Or they might refer to the fed state. Glucokinase is induced in the fed state. Glucokinase production is induced in the fed state. Or they might refer to a high carbohydrate diet. Glucokinase production is induced by a high carbohydrate diet. Let's go to the next control spot. This would be taking us to learning objective number 16. And that's right here that the next control spot occurs in glycolysis. It's the step catalyzed by phosphofructose 9-1. Don't forget the reactions that the enzymes in these control spots catalyze. Let me back up to the first one we just did. Hexokinase's reaction with glucokinase's reaction. Be able to at least tell me the reactants you got use. When I asked you, as I did earlier in learning objective 5, to be able to describe this reaction catalyzed by hexokinase or glucokinase. I at least mean, when I ask you to be able to describe a reaction, I at least mean be able to tell me the reactants of rocks, the main reactants of rocks. Well, they didn't do that for you here. I'm hoping that even though they showed just this much, glucose 6-phosphate, you know the rest of that reaction. And you can tell me there's a reaction where the glucose reacts with ATP. Show an ATP. Remind yourselves of that or practice that. An ATP going in and an ADP coming out. Now you're telling me all the reactants and all the products that the ATP. Okay, and then we got this reaction where they did it for you. They showed you an ATP going in and an ADP coming out, which helps me understand why this enzyme is named like a kinase. It is one of the irreversible steps. It's a control step. And the PFK1 is really maybe the most important control spot. It's the control spot that we talk about most often when we talk about control watch. If I have to think, because I can't trust my memory enough, why is it logical that ATP would be an allosteric inhibitor? And that is a tricky thing to think through. If you get deep enough into it, it gets tricky. Because when you think about it, the reaction catalyzed by PFK1 uses ATP as a reactant. There it is. Nice to show you that ATP is part of this reaction. It's one of the reactants. For the ATP to be used as a reactant, ATP has to go into the active site, or catalytic site of the enzyme. And ordinarily, you think of a reaction should speed up when the concentration of one of the reactants increases. That's probably what your body is, that a reaction speeds up when you increase the concentration of one of the reactants. And up to a certain degree, you find that's true, even for this reaction. Find that as the concentration of ATP increases, the reaction speeds up to a certain extent. But then, something that begins to dominate is the fact that phosphatidyl kinase 1 molecules have allosteric sites for ATP, distinct from the catalytic or active sites. And when the concentration of ATP gets above a certain level, binding of ATP to allosteric sites begins to be quite significant. When the level of ATP rises to a certain level, the binding to allosteric sites becomes significant. And when a phosphofructose kinase 1 molecule has ATP bound to this allosteric site, its shape will change in a way that it works less well, allosteric inhibition. And that begins to dominate to where above a certain level of ATP of the environment leads to PFK1 slows down, or the reaction catalyzed by PFK1 slows down. The higher the concentration of ATP gets, it's about that point, the more PFK1's reaction. And what I described sounded like the binding that the active site has is strong. Would you agree?
I hope so. That makes sense.
If you wanted to know about the relative affinities of two different binding sites have. Rather than out and rationalize ATP meaning in allosteric inhibitor. Citrate is also an allosteric inhibitor, DMK1. And I think you can rationalize that now, especially after being reminded today of citrate's importance in a building project. Citrate leaving the mitochondrial matrix and going out into the cytosol was a way of getting carbons out into the cytosol for building fatty acids. Citrate's appearance in the cytosol in
kinase, meaning this is a reaction where a phosphate gets transferred from a donor to an acceptor. Can you see what the outcome is going to be? One of these is going to become an ATP. And you might say, hooray, we turned one of them back into ATP. But the other becomes an AMP. So now, with this reaction, I've finally explained why the level of AMP rises. The enzyme that catalyzes this reaction has an AMP to it. It's a kinase. Keep that in mind. Do not confuse the name with something that sounds simple. I'll remind you that adenylate refers to AMP. And the enzyme that catalyzes this is called adenylate kinase. It's a kinase, adenylate kinase. And even I need to slow down and make sure I don't say the wrong name because something that sounds very similar is adenylate cyclase. That was different. What was that different? Adenylate cyclase catalyzes the reaction that makes cyclic AMP. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about ordinary AMP being made in a reaction. Catalyzed by adenylate kinase. Why does the level of AMP rise dramatically in a muscle cell that goes from resting to exercising? There's bar graphs on page 410. But I'll project it now. I think we were understanding pretty well with what I drew here that the level of ATP would come down when you go from resting to exercising, and that the level of ADP would go up when you go from resting to exercising. But the percent change in those things is not that dramatic. It says here that the level of ATP decreases only about 20%, and the level of ADP rises only maybe about 50%. But the level of AMP, because of this reaction catalyzed by adenylate kinase, rises from what started off as a very low level to something about 3 or 4 times as high as it used to be. It rises maybe 300%. Maybe even I would notice that. Something around the change in concentration, 300%. So I'm trying to make it sound kind of logical. AMPs rise, might be a significant signal that influences how fast the cell does glycolysis. Thank you. one ready to introduce it. Not only helps control the rate of glycolysis, but also helps control the rate of gluconeogenesis. Just where you can set the changes of gluconeogenesis. And this molecule comes up again as not only controlling glycolysis, but also controlling gluconeogenesis. So think about the liver cell. The cell is capable of both of those pathways and the importance of this molecule in determining whether a liver cell is in a mode to be a glucose user or a glucose producer. A very clever molecule, for example, when you go from fed state to fasted state back to fed state. Changing the mode that the liver cells are in, changing them from being glucose users to glucose producers back to glucose users. That molecule plays this role as fructose 2,6. Bisphosphonate, something I've never mentioned before. You might be remembering from looking at glycolysis that there was an intermediate called fructose 1,6 bisphosphate. I don't need to go to another picture. Here it is right here. Fructose 1,6 bisphosphate. That's an intermediate of glycolysis that has a phosphate at position 1. And it's created in the reaction catalyzed by phosphofructokinase 1. Now I'm getting ready to introduce somebody new. There's not an intermediate on the path. It's only mentioned right here as an allosteric effect of one of the enzymes. Fructose 2,6 bisphosphate. It has a phosphate at position 2. I can tell you what it does. I can tell you where it comes from and what destroys it. I will tell you. But what I can say before you is really rationalize why that molecule ends up playing this role in controlling these pathways in your cells. We'll go ahead and take a help from somebody other than mine. I do want to describe where it comes from and what destroys it, because controlling those things is the destruction, is how the level of glycolysis, but an enzyme that creates fructose 2,6 bisphosphate argue that these two enzymes, PFK2 and F26PGAs, are really kind of tied together. They are two different parts of the same protein, which I'm trying to represent schematically here. Protein is two parts. And one part of this is PFK2, and the other part of this is F26PGAs. Two different enzymatic parts of the same big protein. Because it has these two functional parts, sometimes it's spoken of as a bifunctional enzyme. But that's not a really specific name. There's more than one bifunctional enzyme in your body, you might say. So to more specifically nail down which bifunctional enzyme I'm talking about now, I might name it this way, which might seem kind of awkward. It's a very long title. But I need to say all of this. To really refer to all these parts. My name for this bifunctional enzyme will be PFK2/F26PGAs. Naming both its parts, you see. You might put it in the sense. And it works this way. Only half of it is on at a time. It's either in a shape where its PFK2 part works best, and its F26PGA works. Or, its other possible shape is a shape where it's the reverse. Its PFK2 part isn't working, and its F26PGA part is. And what determines which shape that bifunctional enzyme is in at the moment is whether or not it does a phosphatase. Change the shape of that bifunctional enzyme, change which part of it is on by phosphorylating it, putting the phosphate group on it. And this now can be a story that connects to next month's glucagon messages. Glucagon talks to liver cells, remember? And so a glucagon message, let's see, would that be fed state or fasting state? It would be fasting. Where a glucagon message to a liver cell would be saying, stop using glucose. Slow down glycolysis. And start producing glucose. Speed up gluconeogenesis. That would happen in the liver cell if the level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, level of this, were to decrease. So that must be the way it works. Glucagon messages lead to the level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate decreases. Hence, glycolysis will slow down. Fructose 2,6-bisphosphate is an activator of glycolysis. And if there's less of it now, there will be less activation. Glycolysis will slow down. The flip side is, fructose 2,6-bisphosphate is an inhibitor of gluconeogenesis. So at the same time, just by having the level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate decrease, glycolysis would slow down and gluconeogenesis would be allowed to speed up. Because a decrease in F26PB would be less of an inhibitor of gluconeogenesis, less of an inhibitor. So now gluconeogenesis gets to speed up. So let's connect all the dots here in the other class. The glucagon messages lead to protein kinase A comes up. You can fill in all those steps. Glucagon messages to protein kinase A comes on. And then protein kinase A catalyzes phosphorylation of this bifunctional enzyme. When the liver's bifunctional enzyme gets phosphorylated, the PFK2 side of it turns off. And the F26PGA's side of it turns on. The phosphorylated bifunctional enzyme has a shape that would work you see how now the outcome would be as desired. The level of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. We've slowed down its production.